When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
Somewhere in this apartment, hidden among the collected detritus of a half dozen moves across 10 years, a fossil record of phone chargers, power strips, and old utility bills, there lurks a massive orange spiral notebook, filled with cryptic names, numbers, and abbreviations. It says helpful things like Silverstone GP M3 F Springs plus 2 nano newtons per nanometer. Result, 2 minutes, 58 seconds, 0.338. Which years later tells me that I stiffened the front springs of a BMW M3 at the Silverstone Grand Prix circuit and set a lap time of 2 minutes, 58 seconds and change.
That was the voice of Rob Zachney from his piece, Evidence That You've Taken a Game a Little Too Seriously. I'm Danielle Riendo, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 179. Joining me, and of course Rob today, is Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
And we have a smaller crew today. Austin is on vacation, and Natalie's not feeling well, so you've got the three of us today, and we are going to be talking about games that we've maybe taken a little bit too seriously, and of course the evidence. The somewhat hilarious evidence in some cases that we have taken something a little too seriously. Of course, taking off of Rob's piece here, which was very much about your obsession with these racing simulators. Rob, do you want to tell us a little bit more about how you fell into this rabbit hole?
I mean, the thing is, I can't tell you how I fell into it. Like, it just became a thing I started doing, right? Like, it's one of those things you don't realize that, like, your relationship to a thing has changed until it has changed extensively. And you sort of take stock of it. Like, I think it started to dawn on me that things were a little weird when it occurred to me that, like, it had been weeks since I actually, like, drove in a race. And instead, I had just been, like, tuning cars and documenting every single change. And I was sort of, like, wondering, is this fun? And I wasn't sure, but it was what I was doing. It was rewarding. I don't know if it was fun. But I think what ended up happening was that a lot of sim games in particular, they sort of hint at you that there's this, like, right way to play them. And I think a lot of games do this. There's, like, you can sort of muddle through and blunder forward and, like, find the, either with difficulty settings, you can make it easy for yourself, or you can just sort of cheese your way through, but, like, there's all these signposts that say, like, well, there's a more authentic way to play this. There's a more serious way to play this. Like, mastery lies this way. And I had enough not going on in my life at the time, I guess, to sort of decide, yeah, mastery. That sounds good. And so I, like, started reading up on, like, what all the settings on my car would change and, like, how that would affect handling. And then once I started doing that, I started to realize I'm just kind of fucking with it started with a really important insight. Oh. I realized I had no idea what I was doing. Like, I was just reaching in and, like, fucking with car setups and, like, had no real clue what was happening. And that was actually the important insight that I probably should have stuck with. Like, I'm not a professional race driver. Like, I cannot do lap after lap and keep it within, like, 0.3 of a second. Like, I'm not going to be that consistent. But I convinced myself that, like, no. What's really holding me back is that I'm not documenting my changes so that I can, like, systematize this and, like, gauge how I'm doing with each of these car setups. And my times continue to improve, probably not because I was changing the car, but because I had now raced the same track, like, 80 laps, 90. Like, by that point, yes, I was starting to get really consistent and, like, seeing measurable gains. But I was like, it's probably not the fact that this is, like, my 97th time around this circuit. It's probably those two Newtons that I added to the springs that contributed to my success. So I just kept documenting that shit and making an entire little fetish about it. I found it like kind of weirdly restful and centering. We talked about this a little bit. Like, yeah. Racing games are good at that. And then having this little, like, way to this little, like, rabbit I was chasing of, like, the perfect ideal setup made it even more satisfying to do that. And it wasn't until probably I'd filled that notebook where I started to think, like, it's a little weird, right?
Is this a little weird? Well, I mean, there's an entire practice called speedrunning that is not necessarily about racing games, but that is absolutely what they do. I'm not a speedrunner by any stretch of the imagination, but I do watch speedrunning all day, every day. I kind of have speedruns going on in the background. I have streamers working on their speedruns, and, you know, they have a timer for every segment of the game, and they are obsessively going after these kinds of things. So I feel like that's sort of a, maybe you just had a speedrunning mentality before it was necessarily super popular or common at that point. And also, of course, a racing sim does foster that mentality, right?
Is it possible that Rob is just weird?
This is the real
like
question.
You've done a wonderful job, Danielle, of positioning all sorts and manners of probable explanations. But we also have this other box of evidence of having worked with Rob for a number of years now. Like, maybe Rob's just weird.
Maybe Rob's just weird. Patrick, I think, okay, why don't you present the evidence for maybe Rob's just weird? Now I've said, these are reasonable things that Rob does.
That's not, I did not propose this because I came with a bundle of evidence to it. I was just proposing a theory. I'm not sure if you know how discourse works in 2018, but it does not require me to back up my assertions. Thank you.
True. Rest my case. I guess we are.
Just like Paul Manafort's defense.
Ad hominem. That ad hominem. That's what that is.
That's what it is.
Doesn't count. I blocked it. No, but he
did a blocking motion right there. You can't see it on the radio, but he did a real blocking motion.
Okay, here the question would be, all right, if you look at your own, like, sort of psyche, or, like, do you find evidence of you doing things similar to this in other parts of your life? Like, that's where I wonder if, is it specific to games and sim games, or are, like, sim games, do they scratch at something that you sort of end up doing, like, in other parts of your life? Like, when you go to, when, like, you're going grocery shopping, like, some people have a grocery list, but, like, you know, Rob may have, like, a Google spreadsheet that shows, like, his grocery list from the last, like, 2 years, and so he can be more efficiently get down those aisles.
Okay, well, no. Interestingly, this was probably also when my freelance finances were the most fucked up. There was another notebook.
Oh.
And it contained, like, recipes and then cost per serving. And I was like, I'm systematized budgeting.
Yeah.
All right.
But that hasn't completely gone away. Like, there is an element of, I don't know, like, optimization, I guess. Like, it's not just the grocery list. It's the, like, no, I'm going to go once and I'm going to bring home all the food we need for the next 2 weeks. And also, I am going to, like, before I enter the store, chart the perfect path through the store so I don't have to double back for anything. It's like the Seven Bridges of Königsberg problem, right? Like, I'm going to go through every aisle once, exactly once, not going to cross my own path at any point, and proceed straight to checkout.
Is that real?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I don't hold myself to it. Like, if I forget,
it's not like a psychological, like, neuroses. It's more just like, it turns it into a game for something that's a routine that you have to do every once, you know, or twice a month. Is like, here's like a, especially when you go to the same shop, the same places, you're buying the same things over and over again. Yeah. Like, I hear you on that.
All right.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe
I would be concerned.
Maybe both of you are just weird. No
one should take away from this podcast that I'm doing any of the shopping in my relationship. My wife is meticulous. So she has, similar to you, not where, like, she's charting the perfect path, but my wife, because when we got started, we went out to San Francisco, we had just absolutely no money. Like, not quite paycheck to paycheck, but certainly, like, pretty, just above that. And, like, never really, she grew up, with not a lot of money in the family, and I grew up not not like that, but my mother was just so unbelievably meticulous with her money because she came out of that, where she's like, that's, yeah. I have that sort of ingrained and I've never quite gotten rid of that. And so my, not even though we're in a position where we're doing pretty well financially between the two of us, like there's always ways to optimize. So for her, her thing will be like, okay, like when she goes to different grocery stores, like certain things are cheaper at different stores, not necessarily week to week, just like generally, like, oh, hey, like if you go to Target, like certain things are cheaper there versus like the Whole Foods versus whatever. And so she has like a very meticulous way of buying certain things at certain stores because those certain stores tend to generally offer them cheaper. And so it, she has like her grocery optimizing down to like the efficiency of like these three stores she's going to hit up in a certain order because it's the fastest way to do it and the fastest way to get the cheapest line of things, especially for stuff that you're buying every single week. So
see, I'm hearing that, and I'm like, that sounds like a great idea. What a system. Like, because we got three grocery stores we kind of alternate between. There's, like, the one that's in walking distance. There's the one that's a short drive away. And then there's the Wegmans, which is a date. The Wegmans is a date experience. Like, MK, you and me, we're going to the Weg, baby.
You dress up
we're going.
You put on some cologne.
Oh, we dress down. There's no judgment at the Weg. Just throw on whatever. Those look like pajama pants. It's
socks
fine. Don't,
and sandals.
Don't fucking matter. Your money's green. But yeah. So like, and I'm sitting there. I'm like, you know, but I am certain there are things that are cheaper in one store versus the other. I know this for a fact. But like, old me, and part of me still has this impulse is like, I should document that difference. I should like write down like, how much did the cinnamon cost at like Hannaford versus the Market Basket? Like, I need to know. I mean, I think there's an appeal to optimism and optimism. Freudian slip.
Well, that's 28. Come on, Rob. That is not the life that's the world we live in right now.
optimization. There's an appeal to that, and I think there's also an appeal of like, all this quotidian bullshit that you have to go through each day. What if you could make it have some sort of meaning by like documenting it and having some sort of record that then you can turn into, I don't know, some useful future knowledge that will guide your decisions. There's an appeal to that because then you're always improving. You're always shaving a little extra time off. Always shaving a little money off your budget. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
I have this weird thing where so once or twice a year, I have to do like a 7-hour drive, like to visit some family, and I'm usually the one driving because I don't mind driving, and my wife takes care of our kid because that's a nightmare to have a kid for 7 hours in a car where they can't move. And so you know, I've got the phone, you know, set up on the dashboard, you know, even though I'm going to be on the same road for, you know, roughly 5-6 hours before we get off and never get our way closer. We're pretty much just going east-west. I have this fascination with watching the time to arrival, like, go down. Like, if I can go, not like the arrival time, it's the arrival time, where I can actually shave a minute off if I'm, like, navigating the lanes correctly so I can maintain my speed instead of having to tap the brake. And so it's like probably roughly every like 20, 25 minutes, you end up shaving like roughly a minute off, I'd say is like what it ends up being. It's like every time you like get to like 5 or 10 minutes, like, I mean, like it's a joyous occasion. Like I'm like excited in the car saying like I shaved off 5 minutes. Like hallelujah. These last 2.5 hours this is incredible. And it's like one of the few things I have to like maintain my sanity on that 7-hour drive.
I hear that. I went on a cross-country road trip. It's 9 years ago now, where I went, you know, all the way from, we started in Vermont, we ended up in Portland, Oregon, and then back down to San Francisco. And then
you wrote about this in that article about water tastes like wine, right? It was a good piece about like your memories of this road trip.
Yeah.
People should go read it.
It was really fun. and I remember taking a full hour off after a full day of driving, like, you know, like 9 hours of driving. And I remember taking an hour off that arrival time to like the next stop or whatever it was. And I felt like a god. I felt like a driving god. It was great. So I hear that. And I think there's a lot to this sort of like daily optimization, especially as you were saying, Rob, of like, it gives you a goal in the most boring, shitty parts of your life. Like it gives you something to strive for, something to take satisfaction in. And that's like sort of a beautiful thing. And I think a lot of what's going on psychologically here with your racing games and maybe with your other sort of simmier games, one of the main questions I sort of had here, I guess I'll talk a tiny bit about sort of some of my experiences with obsessing over a game and the signs and symptoms of obsessing over a game. But I do want to get at the question of whether genre kind of matters here and whether or not you are more likely to do this with certain genres, because I know I sure am. Of course, Into the Breach is my obsession right now. I crossed the 600-hour mark last night. And I am now, for me, it's less about documenting and less about sort of, you know, keeping records than it is making my own goals or sort of doing my own weird little thing and sort of creating goals. So I, you know, I got every achievement in this game months ago at this point and just could not stop playing it and literally think about this game in idle moments. Like, you know, I'll be lying there or sitting there doing something and I'm like, you know what feels really good? When you get those bugs to kill each other on the map, when you get like that perfect turn and they start, you know, wailing on each other and that sort of thing. So I know I'm a little obsessed with the game when it invades my thoughts, first of all, and also where I just start making excuses to keep playing it. I definitely did this with Prey to some degree where I was like, no, I need to read every email. I can't stop until I read every email in that game. Or if I see every single room, that's a pretty common one for me. Like, I want to go into every room that it is possible for a player to go into. So for me, it is like some weird combination of goals and like weird little details that I just feel like, no, I've got to have it all. Like it's like a collection thing versus an optimization thing, which is whatever. It, you know, same shit, different day, right? It's just my way of loving something or being sort of obsessed with something as well. The notebook thing. Oh, sorry.
No, I'm just curious real quick. Yeah. Like, but when you go to a place, I'm curious, like, does that translate to like, are you the person there with the, like the list of places you definitely want to hit and see? Like, are you, do you turn into like vacation dad, right?
No, where that's the like weird thing. I, usually when I go to a place, I have a very, sort of bizarre and holistic, feeling towards it. It's more like, yeah, I want to go for a run in this place. That is my main thing.
That's
when I go,
right,
to a new place on vacation. I need to feel it with my feet, which I know sounds very weird. But there's something about running in a new place that really excites me and makes me happy. And I get very, very, very interested in it. And then I'll sort of compare those runs, even if it's on a similar route or the same exact route. I remember going to Tokyo and running in Yoyogi Park like 4 or 5 times just during a few days and just being like, and I saw something new every lap, you know, kind of thing. So, for me, it's like a weird running thing where I just love to explore and explore as much as I possibly can. I'm thinking back and I'm thinking I certainly did. I did the thing with Fez, believe it or not, where I definitely got so into that game that I translated all the language in a notebook. That was a thing that I absolutely did.
I think that's pretty common, though, because the game encouraged it.
It,
right?
Super, so I, did. Yeah.
So I have a notebook full of pages from Fez, but also, okay, you couldn't play that game. Like, you could, like, you just couldn't solve, you couldn't keep certain things in your head, or at least most people were not going to be able to keep certain, yeah, things. Like, that game was explicitly built where, hey, if you want to engage with this game on a certain level, you're going to just kind of have to keep track of things in a way that is going beyond, especially because the game wasn't doing that in any sort of UI, right? It was deliberately,
right,
not building a UI because it wanted you either to transpose that somewhere else, which is what most people did, including myself, to, you know, put a bunch of stuff down, in a notebook. But I find it more interesting when people do that for games that don't necessarily encourage that sort of behavior. Because Fez is like, it's a puzzle game with cryptic things and languages. So like, of course you're going to write shit down.
You're going to write that.
Whereas like an Into the Breach or something like that, or a Prey, where it's not explicitly built all that, other than maybe achievements that are meant to kind of like guide you along and give you new reasons to do things in the world. I think those end up being like pretty different. The daily challenges, right? The rise of the daily challenge,
yeah,
is an explicit reaction to games that people want to spend more time in, but have exhausted whatever is in sort of the main campaign or the main thrust of the original game.
Yeah.
But Robert, I would argue, like, Patrick, you were saying, like, we were discussing this topic, like, this entire topic, like, it isn't you, like, you don't engage with games this way. But, like, it sounds to me like if the game is set up to make you engage with it on that level, if you like the game, you will follow it there. Like, you will become, like, Mr. Scratchpad and notes and making connections.
Yeah, that's true. I just tend to, because I tend to not mull on any one game for a particular length of time. I'm much more the kind of person that gets in, gets out, moves on to the next thing. As you know, I've mentioned before, it's just kind of a virtue of sort of the reporting that I do tends to like encourage me to move to a lot of different games very quickly. It just then by nature of my playing habits, I don't have the time to sort of invest in a game in that way. The closest thing I could think of when I was trying to rack my head around it was, you know, I got very deep into Spelunky for a while because I was trying, you know, I was doing the streaming challenge at Giant Bomb where I was like, hey, watch me learn Spelunky together, and this challenge will end when I get to hell and I've seen the secret ending of the game. But on days where I wanted something different to do, I would also do the daily challenge. And in the daily challenge, I was not good enough to compete on the actual sort of high score board with like anyone that was like, you know, reasonably skilled at that game. So I was competing against people on my friends list, but I didn't have many people. This was long after the game had come out, so I really didn't have that many people playing on the friends list. But Chris Remo was playing constantly. Like, he was like me. He was playing a lot of Spelunky every single... He was doing the daily challenge every single day. I think he did it, if I remember correctly, he did the daily challenge, like, every day for, like, several years, or at least, like, roughly a couple
years. Because I remember he posted on Twitter, like, he was kind of a little shaken when he finally, like, broke that streak.
Yeah, like, I remember, I remember him telling us a story where, like, he was, like, out in the middle of somewhere where there was no internet, and he dragged a laptop with, and then, like, went and found a place where he could get internet so he could just log in and basically fail the daily challenge so he, like, could keep the streak alive. I think he does that with, like, crossword puzzles, too, so maybe that's just a Chris Remo thing that we're pulling out here. But I found myself, there was actually a bot made on Twitter called, I think it was made by Phobewatch, Steve Kim, who's done a lot of really amazing stuff on Twitter for Giant Bomb and Waypoint and other places. It was a bot that would scratch the Spelunky high score data and then created, like, who won that day, Patrick or Chris. And Chris was not really a part of this. Like, he became aware of it eventually as people would, like, yell at him on Twitter, like, yo, you lost today. And he'd be like, a part of what competition? Because I had built this own competition for myself in Spelunky, where it's like, today I'm just going to try and beat Chris Remo. Fuck you, Chris Remo, I beat you today. And then people would be yelling at him saying, ha ha, you fucking lost it's Spelunky to Patrick. And eventually he kind of, like, was participating in the challenge. That's the closest I can think of, and that's was partially because, again, I built that into my life, my work life. Like, that was a feature I was doing. And so then I was able to allow myself to fall into that. But in my personal life, when that's, like, divorced from that, when it's just usually not the case that I enjoy it. I wish I had more chances to do things like that. But it's just not usually where I find myself spending the time where you can actually participate in that way.
Go ahead, Rob. It looked like you had something.
No, I was just thinking, like, I would argue, though, that also seems parallel with, like, the Mario Maker duel with Riker.
Sure, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It seems to me like it seems like you're finding those places when you can get them. If you can get a little, like, I don't know, a little competition going, a little test between you and not just the game, but, like, someone else involved, like, that seems to be maybe that seems to be a unifying factor for you.
I find streaming helps. Like, it's funny because I streamed all of my Dead Cells stuff for the first week and then found it deflating to play the game at home, like, by myself. Like, I found I was dying more. Like, I mean, the whole joke of me streaming that game was that I was the true gamer and I wasn't dying.
You play better
because I was
on
being,
stream.
Like, very careful and meticulous. And then as soon as I was doing it by myself, I was dying and, like, just not paying nearly as much attention. It was just, like, an interesting contrast to the way I perform on stream versus the way I perform when it's just me sitting in a room by myself. And you know, I can see part of what we're talking about here kind of feeding into that a little bit.
I also really do appreciate the, you're doing it for work. So it's almost like an excuse. It's like free, not free, but like a, oh no, there's a reason I'm doing this right here. Like there's like a psychological comfort in that, saying like, no, this is for work. So it's fine if I spend a little extra time here. This is for work. Where I used to be like that until I started playing Into the Breach, and it just warped my psyche in certain ways, because I don't normally think of myself as, you know, the type of person who gets obsessed with a game. This is not, I know it sounds weird. I know. this feels like a relatively new phenomenon for me. Like, in the last year or two, I obviously had this with Prey. It's just nothing has been to the degree of Into the Breach in my entire life. I don't think I've ever played a game for 600 hours before in my entire life. Even as a kid obsessing over Banjo-Kazooie or Mario 64, I'm sure I played hundreds of hours of those games. I sort of doubt that I've played 600 hours of those games. So this feels like a weird metamorphosis for me. It feels very much like, oh, I found a thing that I didn't even know I loved, and I love it. And it does feel a little bit specific to this game, because I obviously really have enjoyed Mario and Rabbids, another awesome tactics game that I've played a lot of, but not 600 hours, right? This is like a new field for me. This is a whole new level. I wonder if I'm becoming you, Rob. I wonder if this is happening. You're like, turn back.
No, I'm saying, like, it's beyond, like, that in particular is like way beyond where I get to with strategy games. Like, that is, you're approaching like Sean Sands from GWJ, like Game King type numbers. He's put in, I think, like 2,400 hours in the EU4 at this point, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, like and he still may not be done with the game. Like, Slay the Spire might have broken his addiction a little bit. Okay. But that is, like, I am a fucking dilettante when it comes to, like, a lot of strategy and tactics games. So, like, I am not the sort of person who ever is like, yeah, I'm going to completely master this and try to get the perfect run. I will briefly tell myself I'm going to try to do that, and that's how I ruin my relationship with a game.
Sure.
In the end, I suspect that notebook ruined my relationship with those racing games. Like, I look back on that really fondly, but there was a point where I just became sort of aware of, like, this is starting to look very work-like, and I am preparing for a thing that I never let myself enjoy, which is just the, like, actual race itself. I'm always like, no, I must perfect my setup. And it was getting in the way of, like, just enjoying the thing, and that sort of eventually sort of put me off those games. So I will never, I never have that moment where I'm like hellbent on having the perfect run, or there's parts of it I can identify with, like the entire getting weirdly pigheaded about, like, a goal I completely made up to myself that, like, has no, like, the game isn't telling you to do this. Like, literally the game is telling you not to do this in some ways. I'll give you an example. For whatever reason, I became bizarrely into Max Payne 2 ages ago. Yeah. Like, I liked that game a lot. I liked it so much that I beat it on all the difficulty levels, and then I think on one of the harder difficulty levels, they limit your number of saves that they'll let you have for each level, so I was like, that seems like a good thing. It'll get rid of saves coming. It was still too easy. And then I was like, hardest difficulty, no bullet time, and no bullet time dodge. And at that point, you're no longer playing Max Payne. That's the thing. I was like, the point of that game is to, like, you know, John Woo style, like, soar through the air and just, like, blaze away. And I was like, but what if we didn't do that? And I enjoyed that. It was, like, hard, and it was a less good game because, like, I was basically ignoring the entire reason the game existed.
The base mechanic.
Yeah. But I was like, no, I just want to show I can do it. And you could, because what, you know, you could do was very cheesily just sort of, like, strafe in and out from behind cover and just shoot things. It was probably a shitty way to play it, but at the time, it made perfect sense. I was like, I'm going to do that. And also, I think with that same run, I was like, and no saves. Like, clean runs through levels. But that is a really unusual thing for me, and it never, like, certainly it doesn't hit the level of, like, 600. Well, that notebook might have had about 600 hours. Across those three games, probably there's about 600 hours of racing involved. But, yeah, that's about where I come down on it.
Yeah, I actually, bringing up Max Payne is a really interesting and good segue into my main question that I've been thinking about this topic, which is, are there just some types of games that do this to you? Or not that will necessarily do it to you, but have a higher likelihood of doing it to you. And it sounds like, Patrick, with some of your stuff, obviously it is more around streaming. It is really more around competition, but it does sound like it's really difficult platformers that kind of can put you into at least some of this mind space. And Rob, it sounds like for you, obviously racing games, that's the biggest one. But
yeah.
Max Payne 2 sounds like a little bit of an outlier there. You know, in third person, it is third person, right?
Yep.
I actually didn't play much of those games. Okay, third person action game, right? And I guess for me, it's this one tactics game that I'm obsessed with. But thinking about this and thinking about how it relates to speedrunning seems to imply that, like, this could happen with anything. Maybe there are some things that make it a little bit more likely to kind of fall into this sort of pattern, this sort of obsessive record-keeping kind of pattern. But I'm interested to see if other people do this with, like, story-based games. And of course they do. There's people who speedrun things like Gone Home or speedrun things like Uncharted. Uncharted speedruns are fascinating, actually, to watch. But I'm curious if either of you had thoughts on this, on whether genre or type of game or type of playstyle, like, will affect this for you, or if you could see it affecting it for you.
I mean, it's definitely true that, you know, yeah, that there is a certain type for me, but I think that often has to do with the fact that those are games that are good for streaming, right? Like,
sure.
a game that is good for streaming that I've had success with are games that evoke emotional and humorous reactions and deeply frustrating, challenging platformers in which I know I'm good at those types of games and can eventually climb whatever mountain they put in front of me, like, makes for a fun stream because it's not just watching someone get frustrated because they don't know what they're doing. It's watching someone get frustrated and learn how to eventually master the thing in front of them. So I think I find myself attracted to those because it's both entertaining for the audience and it's entertaining for me. And I know that if I put in enough time, I can eventually figure out whatever it is.
Yeah. Sounds like there's a satisfaction in that, right? Like, it happens. Rob, you look deep in thought on this one.
Yeah. I think I don't know when it's going to pop up, but if a game gives me a type of problem where I can have a long, like, there's a phase of, like, analysis, planning, and then execution on that plan, that tends to be my shit. And it just depends on, like, what form, like, because the thing that ties the Max Payne thing with the racing thing is that the way, in that playthrough, those final playthroughs with Max Payne where I'm not using bullet time, I'd be sitting there, I knew the layouts of the rooms. Like, at that point, I knew pretty well what I was facing. Besides the third-person shooter, you can always sort of, like, you know, cheese the camera a little bit and, like, sort of, like, crane your neck around and get a view of what you're going into. And so I'd have that, like, moment, you know, outside the room where I'm like, okay, going to cross here. It's going to be, you know, one enemy at 10 o'clock, one at 2 o'clock, get the 10 o'clock, move to cover, and, like, and I'd be like, all right, ready, go, execute. And it was a lot of fun playing that way. And I think the racing games in a similar fashion, I would finish a run and I'd be thinking about, like, okay, well, definitely, like, I was actually, there's a little bit of, the car was actually being held back by, there was just a little too much, like, downforce. There's a little too much, like, wing on it. I can actually make the car a little slipperier. And it's going to be scarier to drive, but, like, it'll be faster down the straights. And I just have to watch that one corner. Now, process that. Think about it. Remember that as you drive. And if a game can do that for me, that is something that I will pour tons and tons of time into. I guess another game that, you know, maybe Danielle, this is my Into the Breach. And I'm going to have to hook you up with this. Unity of Command.
Oh.
Which is basically, like, are you a bad enough Blitzkrieger to knock the Soviets out of the war as Germany in 1941. Now, admittedly, it's basically a Nazi speedrun game. So
I was gonna say, there's some connotations there that are...
Yeah, I mean, like, look.
Look, we said Rob was weird. We established this early up front.
Oh, like, brother, I'm not close to what counts as weird in the, like, World War II East Front, like...
Oh, boy.
Fantasy, like, genre?
Yeah. No, I'm pretty, like, normcore among that crowd.
All right.
In ways that make me relieved to count myself as such. But the thing is, like, so Operation Barbarossa, huge war crime, huge international crime, very cool military operation. And so it's like this, it's a, like basically a near impossible thing the Germans are trying to do, and they come damn close to doing it. And the basic pitch for unity of command is like, can you do it faster and better and achieve all the like maximally difficult objectives set out for you? And it unfolds quickly enough that you're not playing any given scenario for too long. You're very quickly able to internalize like the lessons and go back and try it again and again and again. Now, if you want to play as the Soviets, there's a really good expansion, the Red Turn, that lets you play from their perspective. They control a little bit differently, so they're an interesting problem for you to come to grips with. It's very different from the original set of scenarios. But that was another game where, after a run, I'd sort of be, you know, you'd step away from the computer and I'd sort of be sitting there being like, well, okay, but what am I going to do about those Soviet infantry in that swamp? Like, what, like, how do I get them out of my fucking way? And you just sort of work on that problem. And then you load up the scenario, you'd stare at the map for like, you ever seen Searching for Bobby Fischer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Love that movie. I think the cinematographer on it, Conrad Hall, said it was his favorite of the movies he'd worked on, which is pretty wild considering I think he was on The Godfather. But
yeah, I'm pretty sure he was.
Yeah, yeah. He's a great cinematographer. But there's this scene that I always love. It's when Ben Kingsley's character like teaches young Josh Waitzkin to see the board, basically. And he does it by like throwing all the pieces aside, and the only thing left is like the enemy king. And he's like, just, you have to, you know, he says this thing like, just visualize it, remove all the complications until you see the opponent's king standing there alone like a guy under a street light. And I think that's a great way the movie captures those moments of breakthrough and insight where you see the problem, the whole problem in its entirety, and then how to deconstruct it and break through it. And I think that is the thing that I'm like, that, like, if I get like the scent of that in my nostrils, I will chase it. Doesn't matter the game.
This is both amazing and exciting, the part of my brain that's obsessed with Into the Breach, and exciting the part of my brain that has been training ridiculously lately for my first tournament. Like, this is also jujitsu, which is called human chess all the time, sort of like chess with limbs,
basically. I thought human chess was the thing that supervillains did in their like compounds where it's like you force people to play as the pieces and like the pawns have to strangle each other.
It's true, actually. It's a different thing, you know, very slightly different thing, you know. We all have a little bit of that going on, right? Wait, you don't have a human compound of chess people?
I mean, it's aspirational at this point. Like, I plan on it at some point. Like,
we're
a few years away from
Helen. It's in Rob's third notebook that he doesn't show his partner.
Yeah.
He doesn't show that one off.
Yeah. You know who had it all figured out was the Red Queen.
Oh. On that note, I think we should take a quick break, and we'll come back for some questions. But... Thanks, Red Queen. All right, we will be right back.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's take a couple of questions here on this beautiful Friday. It is actually a very beautiful Friday. I'm pretty happy about it. Rob, I picked this one for you. This is a very Rob question. I guess we're having a very Rob episode today. Yes, exactly. Just, it's very good. It's very good. Some days we have a Rob episode. You know, it's just like Star Trek when you have the focal point is on one character. It's very nice. All right. This is from Andrew in Baltimore, who writes in, "Hey, Waypointers. I've been recently getting into the Total War series, and it's made me think a lot about, well, war. In Total War, I make a lot of strategic decisions that seem to be necessary as a commander, i.e. preemptive strikes, forcefully taking important geographical areas, etc., even though in a real-life scenario, I would be horrified by them. Obviously, these are just computer games, so the stakes are non-existent, and I'm usually trying to take over the world anyway. But sometimes I'm just trying to hold on to what I have, and wars are necessary to beat back impending threats. It occurs to me that while I truly abhor war and violence, I could start to see how someone dispassionately reading a situation may decide it's a necessary option. Have war games or strategy games influenced how you think about war and international relations? Nice heavy one for you there, Rob. Hey, what are you thinking?
Oh, boy. So I do this thing. I do the same thing. Like, I play these games suboptimally because, like, I try to respect treaties and, genuinely try to avoid turning on allies and becoming a giant war criminal. Like, I know that, like, the character I played on Stellaris streams, like, aside, in general, like when I'm actually playing these games for real, even if I go in saying, like, all right, time to be space Genghis Khan or something, I will inevitably be like, or I could build liberal international institutions and win peacefully. And I don't know. It's the lately I've been trying to break myself of that habit and, you know, remind myself that, you know, in these games, in the words of like Hans Morgenthau, you know, we meet under an empty sky from which the gods have departed. That the point is to win. Like, everyone is playing by the same rules of just screw your neighbor, try to win the game by any means necessary. Even the peaceful victory conditions still probably will require you to at some point find a way to utterly, like, kneecap somebody. And I'm trying to, like, get better at following that logic for the games because, I guess, I don't know, it's this weird thing. The narrative I tell myself is that at the end of the game, my people will be, like, you know, no greater friend, no worse adversary, right? Like, that is the character I would like to be at the end of these games, and I will try to find different ways of realizing that. But the lesson a lot of these games teach, and something that definitely does remind me of a lot of my days as an, you know, undergraduate IR theorist, basically, like somebody who studied that shit, that in these games, like, trying to play by different rules than the rest of the actors in the system are operating under is actually unethical. Is actually, like, trying to be better than the world around you, at least in these games, ends up being, like, self-defeating, and it is to the profit of the worst people and to the cost of the best, or at least to the people that you were, like, sort of charged to lead. So it's a weird thing. Like, there's an inherently, like, realpolitik, like, fascistic element to a lot of strategy games. And if you try to resist it, they do kind of end up, like, whispering in your ear, you know, well, you know, the game's the game.
Yeah. Game is the game. I'm reading the third book in the Expanse series, and just last night there was something extremely, extremely pointed towards this that sort of happens. It's between sort of Anna, who's a preacher. Have you watched the third season of the Expanse at all? Okay. I actually haven't, so I don't know how much Anna is in the third season.
She's very much in it.
She's very much in it. Okay. She has this moment where shit is going down. I'm not going to spoil anything, but bad shit is going down. War is happening. Battles are happening. And she sort of looks around at the chaos around her, and she feels like, well, we're already a failure if we've gotten to this point. Or if we've gotten to the point where violence is going to happen. She kind of has this little quote. Oh, see, look how cute. I'm reading from a book. See, isn't this nice? All right. So I'll read this tiny little bit right here. It's very relevant. A history professor at university had once told her, "Violence is what people do when they run out of good ideas. It's attractive because it's simple, it's direct, it's almost always available as an option. When you can't think of a good rebuttal for your opponent's argument, you can always punch them in the face." And so she's this very, she's a preacher, she's very idealistic, she has her PhD in theology. She's a really interesting character. She's also queer. I don't know if she is in the show, but she's married to a woman, has a baby with a woman. And, like, that's always interesting to me when, you know, sort of futuristic society religion is queer inclusive. I'm like, oh, that's that's very nice. That's pretty cool. But anyway, she has this incredibly idealistic view of the world. And later on in that scene, she sort of contends with the fact that, like, this is fucking happening, whether she wants it to or not. So she kind of has to make the best of it, whether or not she's ideologically opposed to violence or not. It's happening around her. And the best she can do is try to basically inspire people to come together and do what she's good at, which is talking to people and sort of leveling with people and you know, appealing to their best natures. That's very much what Anna is there to do. So this question struck me as also very interesting in that, like, I hit that little passage last night reading the book, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. No easy answers, of course, as always, but it seemed relevant, so I got it out.
Yeah. The other thing I do try to remind myself of is in stories and especially in games, there's this idea of like hidden curricula. Troy Goodfellow talks about this all the time. That like, so that little insight I just like offered up about like what these games teach. One of the ways they teach that is because you are trapped within a system that is designed to operate this way, right? Like that the lesson is kill or be killed, screw thy neighbor. But that is because somebody like specifically said this is going to be the overriding message of this game. And that is the danger of like not being critical of the things you're playing or the things reading. Like, it's very easy to like read that or play that and be like, yeah, good insight about the world. Well, it's an insight about the world, but it's not necessarily like prescriptive. It is given a scenario that where it is made to seem very like accurate and prescriptive. But somebody set very hard constraints around what is possible in that framework.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Our second question is a little lighter. And this one is from Joe. And I'm actually really curious to hear, Patrick, what your thoughts are on this one. Because this one's really
all right,
fun.
Joe, bring it the fuck on.
Come on, Joe. Okay. It's a fun one. It's a fun one. I like this one. All right, Joe says, I'm catching up with the podcast, and I was reminded of the machine Miss Jacob in the hand in Killer 7 book. Apparently, Killer 7 has a book and it's Machine Miss Jacob. Okay, I never played that game, so whatever.
I didn't play Killer 7 either.
So, Miss Jacob in the hand?
Are we sure that's based on was Killer 7 popular enough to get a book based on it?
I'm really interested. Well, they go on a little bit here, so I'll read the rest. Right. I guess this explains it a little better. Sorry that I was editorializing there already because I was like, interesting. But here we go. Miss Jacob is a machine described in the book as a device that can make predictions with increasing accuracy as each prediction comes true. This device is at the core of the story of Killer 7, as a rogue FBI agent is using this machine to manipulate the Smith Syndicate, the player's characters, to eliminate the game's enemies, the Heaven Smile. None of this is addressed at all in the main game. The only connecting tissue to these events is the save function made Samantha Sitbin. Yet only the craziest non-Japanese speaking fans of Suda 51 and his works are aware of this somewhat critical piece in understanding what exactly the heck is going on in this game. So the question I have is this: what is your favorite piece of extracurricular material that helps you understand something? Not just a favorite game, but even in a movie, book, or even like a phrase that's in a game or a movie that like some critical piece, or I guess it doesn't have to be critical, but something that's really, really just so tertiary to the game or the experience that helps you genuinely understand something about that world. I'm really curious because you've played a lot of games, Patrick.
Yeah, curiously, I don't. I'm struggling to come up with an example in video games, partially because I don't tend to get too invested in video game lore.
Okay, you're not like that. Natalie playing it for the lore. I see.
No, again, I get into stories and settings, but I've yet to. I can't think of a video game that I've played in which I, other than like the stuff that I got into when I was a kid, where it's like I was, you know, super obsessed with like Final Fantasy VII, but that's had less to do with Final Fantasy VII than it was that I had a whole summer and I had to fill that summer with something, and I had Final Fantasy VII in front of me. Sort of like outside of video games, like, you know, I use any excuse to bring up Lost, but like that was a show that like sort of was the modern template for like building for storytelling in which external sources informed it. Not necessarily in the sense that you would go find some piece of lore hidden on a website, although they did do things like that, that informed like the larger story, that wasn't required for the day-to-day storytelling, but maybe give you a better sense of the mechanics and informed the storytelling that was happening in front of you. More was that I really enjoyed after every episode, like there was a this writer, Doc Jensen, he went by on Entertainment Weekly, and he did these long, like, deep dives into every episode where, like, I mean, he was writing like 2,000-3,000 words on every episode every week, like these 7-8 page things he went up on Entertainment Weekly that would, like, was very much a reaction to, like, what was that thing in the background? Like, I looked up, like, these Wikipedia entries and these books about it, and like, how does this maybe inform, like, the mythology of the island and what's going on? And so those became, like, an external source that I found, like, deeply satisfying and interesting and edifying to read, that informed and enhanced my understanding of the base television show, even if you could watch that base television show without any of this stuff and, like, you'd be just fine. But as a sort of, like, super fan of the mythology, I was constantly looking for external sources. I mean, Lost is, like, I didn't really do that with any other TV show either. Like, Lost is, like, remains, like, the one time that I became so enraptured that I was sort of doing every possible thing in and around it, because for whatever reason, that world just really grabbed me.
Nice. Rob, how about you?
I don't know. I think the Grimoire in Destiny is a clear example of, like, an interesting assembly of, like, tertiary lore and explanations for stuff that, like, didn't totally map one-to-one into the game, which actually just, like, deepened the feeling that there are, like, all these mysteries and, like, hidden depths to Destiny. And then as Destiny begins to, like, diverge even from kind of the rules they lay out in those lore cards, and, like, Destiny 2 becomes much more of a straightforward
the darkness? What's the darkness?
Yeah, exactly. Like, honestly, I think that was the beginning of the
end.
We'll
get around to that in the third game once we figured out how we retconned it back in.
Yeah. Oh, and I think that was, like, the interesting part of this, and I think it sort of it parallels a little bit with like reasons why maybe nerds got angry at Star Wars in places is 'cause, like, so you have a pretty simple and straightforward, like referent object, right? Like, the original trilogy of Star Wars ain't that fucking deep. Like, there are not that many real mysteries implied. There's a few, like, names tossed out there that you can wonder, like, oh, I wonder what that's about. But really, it's not that big a universe, and it doesn't really follow any clear rules, not even internally. And what happens there is there's this whole cottage industry of, you know, expanded universe stuff, creating additional explanations and further backgrounding to this world and, like, greater context. Some of it's trash, but some of it's really, really good. And people, like, start to really value just this entire, like, separate category of knowledge about the universe. And then it all gets torn up. Basically, as the prequels come along and demolish that, and a lot of the explanations turn out to be dumber than you can possibly have imagined.
So much worse.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's one of those things where, like, in the absence of, like, a continuation of the main films, the universe becomes more interesting because they keep letting different authors come in and, like, play around in it, right? Different creators come in and tell a little story. The Dark Forces series yes. tells a separate little story about Star Wars. You know, the list goes on. And Destiny as well is a really kind of silly shooter, right? We're Undying Guardians, and somehow we're the only people who can beat these incredibly powerful aliens. The trick is shooting them with automatic weapons, which humanity was unable to do prior to the existence of the Guardians. Like, machine guns, who knew? But in the Grimoire, there's this entire suggestion that, like, is this dumb story you're being told? Is this shallow little superhero fable you're being spun? Is it perhaps, like, much more interesting than is letting on? Like, is the universe maybe as deep and as richly textured as the skyboxes that surround you, you know, throughout that game? And the Grimoire, you could sort of imagine that it was. Like, maybe none of what we're being told is the truth. Like, what's that speaker up to? Is the Traveler really good? Because it seems to have brought a lot of trouble to our door and done fuck all to help. And the answer is the Grimoire is a holdover from what Destiny like was originally going to be. Like, it's vestigial. And now we're sort of in what the real plot of Destiny is. And it's, yeah, immortals with automatic weapons. That's that's basically it. That's Destiny. And it's this double-edged thing, because as long as there's this like separate category of like lore and knowledge out there to tease and excite, can make something pretty simple seem a lot more interesting. But then eventually you have to start like explaining what actually is going on and maybe start contradicting some of like the theories out there. And things can turn fast.
Well, that's what makes Star Wars so fascinating, because when Disney bought it and they did The Force Awakens, they explicitly disavowed, but they said, starting with this, we're cutting off the extended
universe. That's the Legends like, timeline or something like that.
Right. Yep. It was really fast, like from a corporate standpoint, it's like, well, you know, you could see the cynical view of doing that. But from like a creative standpoint, I thought it was like a really interesting decision to say, okay, we're cutting this off. But what they didn't actually do was cut it off. They've just instead said, okay, that's just basically a whole rich history that we can pull from, right? Like, they brought Thrawn back in Star Wars Rebels or
yeah,
whatever it is.
And now in a book, and,
yeah. And there's, like, elements of the extended universe that, like, you know, have cropped up in the mainline movies. But they basically said, like, oh, we're just going to pull, like, the good stuff or the stuff we find interesting that, like, fits, you know, what we want to do going forward. But it's, like, a fascinating way to treat, like, the structure that has supported Star Wars, you know, in between the films. And in a lot of ways became Star Wars for... Like, the stuff around the films became Star Wars for people in the absence of, like, a continued narrative through line in movies. And then for Disney to come in and say, all right, we're axing all that stuff, but we're bringing some of the stuff in and getting rid of most. It was just a really interesting creative decision, given the structure that Star Wars had for a number of decades.
Yeah. And I was one of those kids in every way.
Same.
Like, who read every one of those damn books. So, and played a lot of the games and got
I read Dark Forces and I think I read Shadows of the Empire. Not so coincidentally, because they were video games. And that was just an excuse to see more of the video game that I'd played.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. When you're 13 or 12 or whatever, that's fair.
I read the Doom books, all right?
You?
Knee Deep in the Dead.
There
was a lot of sex
in those
Dune
books.
I think you said
the Dune books, and I was like, oh, there's like Kevin J. Anderson.
There's a lot
like...
of sex in those. Well, there's some. I don't know.
I still
there was
have
a lot of sex in the Doom books.
I was shipped a copy of the Doom books when someone was getting rid of them on Twitter. And then I tracked down the authors of the Doom books and pitched them on, hey... We should talk about these Doom books sometime when I get a chance to read them. Have not done that, but do have the email out there. So
one day.
I can find an excuse to reread some parts of these sex-filled demon books, I can ask them why they put so much sex in those Doom books.
I'm so interested. Wow. I really am. I actually am, like, so invested in what happened there. So I hope to read that story one day.
Like, basically Doom erotica? Is that how it comes off?
Not like that, but it... I just remember at the age that I read it on, I was reading those books on the bus to and from school in middle school.
Yeah.
So, right. You know, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. It was not content appropriate for me at that age, really. So I may in my head be thinking, like, man, they were fucking on every other page of that book. Which, in reality, it may just be that, like, there was one sex scene. But for, like, a 6th grader, it was like, holy shit. Like, this, bend the antenna on the back of this to see if you can get... HBO boobs to show up because your neighbor got the cable and it bleeds through if you're close enough to the neighbor that has the cable. What? I don't know what I'm talking
about. That's the struggle. You know, that's the struggle when you're 12, right?
Teenagers know what I'm talking about, bending the cable in the back.
No, not the teenagers have no idea what the fuck you're talking about now. Like,
no, I'm saying not teenagers now. I mean,
oh, right,
people
right.
that were
90s teens.
Yeah, 90s teens that had neighbors that had cable. They paid for, like, HBO and Showtime, and it's like, maybe you could get, what was the David Duchovny one?
Oh, Red Shoes?
Yeah, Red Shoe Diaries to
oh,
come in. And
yeah.
You could, it was weird. You could, like, literally bend the cable and, like, get the signal to come in, like, anyway.
That's amazing. That's incredible.
Yep.
Wow. Now we know so much about your life, Patrick. We know so much.
How does this fit into the unified Doom theory? No, I'm
Fuck, man. I am so excited for Doom Eternal. One, that game looks amazing.
Yeah.
Two, I am so excited that one of the pillars of the sequel is that, yo, we're building a Doom universe. I am here for it.
Yes. That is fucking awesome. I guess on the slightest, quickest note, Bethesda and universes, one of my favorite little tertiary things are the terrible fucking Starbender sci-fi books in Prey. Like these
awful,
atrocious, just like shit fiction. Like, I just love like any fiction in any game. Like the fiction in that world is always very, very fun for me to read and see like, oh, what does this say a little bit about this world? Although I think in this case, it's just an excuse to write the most purple fucking prose, like sci-fi fantasy bullshit that some writer at Arcane just got to have a goddamn field day with.
It does a decent job though of channeling the type of like Drek you'd find in like the sci-fi fantasy section of like Borders back in the day. Like the stuff that it was like, yep, okay, it's a licensed book. It's a licensed series at this point, and this is book number 72 written by our third tier writer. Here we go.
Yep. Our first two tiers are busy working on like some like multi-arc book. So here's, you know, here's John Turnpage with his, you know, one-off piece of shit. It's delightful.
I'll say this. It was useful for me getting into the Star Wars canon as it was constructed back then, because it was the first moment I realized that canon was kind of bullshit and like unsustainable. Because like Kevin J. Anderson shows up early in that series and starts, like, two things happen. There's a really dumb, there's this Dark Horse comic series that I think makes a lot of questionable creative decisions. And then Kevin J. Anderson shows up and also makes a really real travesty of a trilogy. It's the standard Kevin J. Anderson shit. There is no actual through line. There's just a series of like vaguely exciting events that happen and then are sort of constructed into an overarching story. It's terrible. And so like early on, that expanded universe just goes off the deep end. And as a kid, I was like, this seems really hard to square with the good stuff. Like, it seems bad, but it's real because it's canon. It's like all this happened, but it seems totally inconsistent with like everything we know about the universe and these characters. I'll just pretend it didn't happen because a lot of subsequent authors also seem to be ignoring it. And it was like useful and instructive because it was like the moment I realized, yeah, you know what? It's okay if stuff that takes place in a universe or an IP you like is bad. You don't have to like let it taint your enjoyment of the thing. You can just look at it and be like, yep, they sucked that one. They sucked that one right out. Just totally hosed it. Kevin J. Anderson, you done it again. And he would do it again with Dune, by the way. If you ever read those books. Boy.
See, you learned the lesson that, like, the Star Wars nerds who got very mad and vote with their wallets didn't learn that maybe not everything's for you. And that's okay.
I suspect maybe
you can move on with life.
I suspect those guys are bitter in part because they were like, no, all this is real. And I made myself love those books. I memorized all the shit that shows up in the Dark Horse comic series. Yeah, give me that galaxy gun. I've got the technical manual for that. And then Disney comes along and is like, yeah, this is shit. Out the window, all of it. It's all garbage. And like, what are you going to do?
A woman has a sword.
You spent 30 years building your identity around like Kevin J. Anderson's Kessel Spice Spider.
Spice Spider.
Oh, yeah. No, Han Solo goes to Kessel and gets press ganged into becoming a Kessel Spice miner. It turns out the Kessel Spice is woven by some sort of spider monster, and it hunts the miners, and it's bad.
There's definitely, in one of those stories of the et cetera, there's definitely like a very Volcel Boba Fett who is very upset about drug use and sex and sexuality, and it is fucking wild to go back to.
Wait, is that in the Tales of the Bounty Hunters books? Is that the one where
I think it is.
Yeah. I was always more of a Dengar guy myself. I felt bad for that dude.
Yeah, same. The other Tales of the Bounty Hunters stories, I remember them being kind of fucking awesome.
Some of them were
great.
That
one, even as a kid, I was like, wow, he's really...
And that's the one they end on. It's weird. You're like, wait, Boba Fett is like a religious zealot? And yeah. But at the same time, it's a very interesting story because it takes place out of like chronology. Like, it's sort of a... what's the way to put it? It's like him and Han Solo encountering each other at the end of their lives, basically, and you have no idea where or when you are in the Star Wars chronology by the end.
It's a weird one.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. It's bad, but like kind of interesting as well.
It is fascinating. Mm. Yeah, if you can track that down, it's wild to experience that one as an adult. And I remember even being a kid, being like, "Wait, is he like a monk?" Like, is that what we're going for here?
He's like a defrocked monk, right? They were like, whoa, you're a little weird kid. And he was like, my morality, I will enforce it with a gun.
It's very much that. It makes so much sense. It really does. All right. I guess that's... See, I knew that one would inspire some some good discussion. I think that is it for us today. Unless you have more Boba Fett thoughts.
Do I have more Boba Fett? Yeah, you bet your ass I have more.
That's another podcast. Yes. We're going to do a Boba Fett cast one day. That'll be great. You know, you heard it here, kids. Waypoint 101, Boba Fett. Can't wait. Maybe that'll be a whole series. I can't promise that, but I can promise you that you can send questions to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. And I can also promise you that we will do shout outs to Boen for letting us use his track, Miss You, off of the EP Pale Machine. We are on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. We're on twitch.tv/Waypoint. And you can read everything we do at waypoint.vice.com. Rob, where can we find you online with your Boba Fett thoughts?
At Rob Zachney.
Awesome. Patrick, where can we find you online with your...
You can find me at Patrick Klopik.
All right, you can find me at Danielle R.I. if you care to. And of course, I will remind you to please be good and be good at it.
Kip Durham sucks. Fuck that guy.
Yeah, he did.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.